Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're here. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. So much to report. It's been a wild week. Frank Bisignano was going to be with us today. He's running the Social Security Administration, and it's the 7th annual Slam the Scam Day. It's coming to the March 5th. It happens each year. Americans lose hundreds of millions of dollars to fraudsters. He's trying to crack down on that. And he's single-handedly fixing Social Security. The guy's a genius who has begged to come out of Wall Street to help out, and he's really worked out. Brett Baer's with us, too, chief political anchor for Fox News, anchor of Special Report, also the host of the Brett Baer podcast and author of To Rescue the Republic. We're going to get to all that, but first let's get to the big three.
Number three.
How many people have been indicted in your state right now? Do you know, Governor?
I don't have those numbers with me.
But you've never said to stop payments.
It's one of the highest rates in the country, sir.
Well, you have one of the highest fraud rates in the country.
Yep, fraud front and center. It's the scrutiny is on Minnesota. To me, Waltz and Ellison are much more guilty than they let on.
Number two.
This will definitely be temporary. The Trump administration's energy addition, energy dominance agenda have just massively grown global supplies of oil, natural gas. But yeah, are we going to have a transient bump up as we've seen in gasoline prices? We do a little bit.
Yep, cost to the economy. We're going to look at this war and the degree of short-term pain on energy. Will America be patient enough to allow Trump to win this war?
Number one.
For the first time since 1945, a United States Navy fast attack submarine has sunk an enemy combatant ship using a single Mark 48 torpedo to achieve immediate effect, sending the warship to the bottom of the sea.
That's a little of what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dan Kane, had to say about our operations taking place in the Middle East. A torpedo takes out their biggest and best ship. The Navy is gone, virtually gone, of Iran's. U.S. and Israel ramping up targets, eliminating their Navy, as I said, focusing on leadership and launchers. We have the very latest, as well as some of the turmoil on Capitol Hill for people playing partisan politics. I expect it if the war lingers on and things went south. But to have people say, like Hakeem Jeffries, is going to end up in defeat? Really? You want to be the next Speaker of the House, and you're telling the American people, essentially you're rooting for defeat with the President of the United States. I saw what Senator Mark Kelly said. You're not going to believe this. The astronaut, former fighter pilot, had this to say. He says, as I watch this group of people who are supposed to be leading our country, not just the president, Secretary of Defense, and others, you know, five people that were on the background of the background on the slide here, and I'm thinking, I don't know what that means, but that's what he said, and I'm thinking you can pick a random group of people off the street tonight, right here in D.C., just a random group, and they could probably do a better job than our government is doing right now. What war is he watching? You might not, you know, you want to say, I don't think you should have gone in. I'm ready for that. But the execution of the military and the mission so far, along with the second best military in the world, working in tandem. Brett Baer joins us now. Brett, the partisanship didn't take long, did it? Outside Senator Fetterman, you know exactly where people stand by the party they're in.
Yeah, good morning, Brian. I think it's predictable. Unfortunate, but predictable. You can have major skepticism. You can raise sure. legitimate questions. You can ask questions about how long this is going to last. Is it worth the country's mm-hmm. blood and treasure? But to diminish what's happening or happened as a, you know, just purely the U.S. military precision, I don't know, it just seems out of place. And you have to kind of give it just a little time to see exactly what they're doing. They're questioning the objective, the long term, how long it'll last. But I mean, they've had a lot of success in a short time. And, you know, again, you can ask whatever question you want to ask, but it seems like rooting against them is not the way to go.
So you had the former Secretary of State, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice on your show last night. Great interview. Here's a little of it when she talks about the objective here. Cut 7.
If you can render Iran essentially incapable of military action against us and against our allies, that's worthy. And I think what they're trying to do is to neuter Iran as a military power in the region. And by the way, the Iranians, who I think made a strategic blunder in attacking the Gulf states like the UAE or Kuwait or others, is demonstrating that it is its goal to be a destabilizing force in the Middle East. Yes, you can still be concerned about what may come after. You can still be concerned about the uncertainties of warfare. But to render this awful regime incapable of using its military power, that's a worthy goal.
And I thought that was put wonderfully for someone who probably hasn't been read in, but lived with Bush 41, was on part of that staff, and she had important roles with Bush 43.
Yeah, listen, she's been in every big decision at a time of war, behind the scenes, behind closed doors, in the halls of power. And I think she, when she articulates it, she comes from a place of knowledge. She comes from a place of experience. And I think she cuts through the noise. And what she's saying there is that, yes, there are questions. Yes, there's the possibility that things could go south. But that doesn't diminish the objective or the goal of taking away this horrible regime's ability to take down U.S. bases in the region, to threaten its neighbors, to be a nuclear threat with kind of crazy people running the country.
So, you know, if you think about what happened in 2023 with the attack October 7th, Sinwar thought he was going to lead the world against and get finally rid themselves of Israel, against Israel. Hezbollah is going to join in. Iran would eventually join in, and they'd get rid of that country, especially with a president they perceived as being weak and a vice president they thought would be next that we know is weak. And they've had that. Now, think about what has ultimately happened. Sinwar's dead. Hamas is on its back. Hezbollah is about to be finished off. And Iran has been degraded in a way they didn't think was possible. And we have the Sunni Arab Gulf states who are seemingly well on our side and ready to take offensive action. That's not the way the Islamic extremists thought this would play out.
No, definitely not. And I do think to Secretary Rice's point, it was a real strategic blunder to attack as much as they have those Gulf Arab allies of ours, UAE, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar. And they've unified and given, you know, stiffened the spine of those countries that originally, you know, at the very first bomb dropping, put out public statements saying they were against that kind of action. Now they're supporting the U.S. and Israel. And as you say, they're on the cusp of launching their own counter offensives.
How real do you think are a weapons depletion? How much is that concerning, do you think, behind closed doors with the Pentagon and the White House? Because we hear about interceptors, and we know the Gulf states don't have a ton, and they're forced to use them to knock down, you know, what is it, $20,000 drones using a $4 million interceptor. So what do you hear, Brett?
I think they're doing less of that. I think they're doing more of the technology to block drones and to take them out of the sky. Believe it or not, Ukraine has assisted
in
some of that. They are on the cutting edge of drone technology and counter drone technology, and so they are offering their assistance. So I think they're doing less of the $4 million interceptor for the drone. But it is an issue. I mean, it depends on how long this goes. And so timing becomes really critical. And I think the magic number, you've heard it from the president numerous times, 4 weeks. You know, we're on week two. And I think, you know, they're getting to a point where they're saying, you know, we're not even to the big part of the campaign. I don't think it's going to go that long, and I doubt that there's going to be boots on the ground that are our boots. Mm.
And a lot of that is the president says, I'm not going to tell you my strategy. I'm not going to tell you about limitations. So when people say, do you rule out troops on the ground? He says, I'm not going to say that. So they go, oh, there could be troops on the ground. And that's used as a political talking point. But do you understand that you can't have it both ways? You can't say, I'm not going to play my hand and tell you my hand, at the same time play and show you his hand. To me, it makes total logical sense. But I want to bring politics into this, especially from where you're from and where you are in D.C. And the thing that's going to change in 26 and definitely 28, you're going to have every Democratic candidate finding a way to criticize and move away from Israel, including, I believe, Governor Shapiro, who's Jewish and pro-Israel. And if you want proof of that, the weather vane of politics, who knows how to read a poll, if nothing else, Gavin Newsom. Listen to what he calls Israel. This would normally be death to any candidate. Cut 23.
The issue of Bibi's interesting because he's got his own domestic issues. He's trying to stay out of jail. He's got an election coming up. He's potentially on the ropes. He's got folks, the hard line, that want to annex the West, the West Bank. I mean, Freeman and others are talking about it appropriately, sort of an apartheid state.
Really? An apartheid state? That sounds like a Palestinian talking point. Here's more. Cut 24.
Do you think, looking down the road, that the United States should consider maybe, you know, rethinking our military support for Israel?
It breaks my heart because the current leadership in Israel is walking us down that path where I don't think you have a choice but that consideration.
And if you want to get votes from the extreme right and from, I guess, most of the left, Brett Baer, you tell me if you think I'm overstating it, you're going to have that position at least. And that, to me, is sad. And it's a five-alarm fire for the Israelis who will say, regardless, I have to finish off our enemies now, and we got to find a way to make our own weapons today.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think that it's really amazing listening to some of the rhetoric, not only from the Gavin Newsoms and the far left, but the right side, way right, and some of that is really eye-opening and doesn't seem to understand the reality of Israel under threat from a lot of its neighbors for a long, long time. And you can dislike Bibi Netanyahu or how he's running things, but the existential threat to Israel is beyond party. I mean, no matter which leader is at the helm in Israel, that's going to be something that's always been evident. So, you know, to even talk about U.S. decoupling from Israel is kind of just a major thing. And I think it will be a part of politics coming up. And I think you're already seeing positioning. I'd be surprised if Shapiro did it. I think he's going to have a hard time running in that party if it is designed that way, as is. So I think we got a long way to go. The midterms are going to tell us a lot. Mm-hmm. If Democrats manage to take control of one section, one chamber of Congress, it's going to be a bumpy road for this administration or somebody who wants to run in 28 from this administration, you know, going forward.
Brett Baer, our guest, Brett's show tonight, 6. So, Brett, another big story coming up as this war, I think the president says, I'm looking 3 or 4 weeks, and there's some nervousness that in Israel that the president will end it early. I just hope he achieves his objectives. And I think AI is playing a major role in why it's been so effective so far. I'm just reading about that. Pretty awesome. But I got to ask you about the other big event, and that's the president's visit to China. Do you believe, even though they haven't said anything publicly that critical of us, between Venezuela and now Iran, two allies of theirs, do you think that trip is in jeopardy?
I don't think so. I think the President, well, first of all, from China's point of view, I think they want to make deals. They want to figure out how to move forward with the U.S. From the president's point of view, I think he looks at it that he's in a better negotiating point after Venezuela, and we'll see what happens in the coming weeks in Iran. But both of those places provide a lot of oil and energy to China. And I think most experts say that it's weakened China in the wake of this. I think China is going to move forward with that visit. I'm scheduled to be on that visit to take the show on the road. And so it'll be fascinating, especially during that time.
I don't know how it works. Do you get a plus one? Do you think I could go with you?
To sneak in? Yeah.
No, I mean, they say and guest. Does it say on the invitation, Brett Baer and guest?
Yeah. Can you carry the tripod?
I would. I'll do anything. Yes, absolutely.
Light case?
Yes, and I will not come out against communism because I want to be able to come home. All right, Brett, who's have you named your panel yet, or have you named the finalists?
We're down to about 20.
Okay.
So we'll get it down to three.
By noon, well, you're just going to post up the starting roster. Is that the way it works?
Exactly.
Brett Baer.
When are you coming back on?
I don't know. Just all you have to do is ask me. When are you coming to New York again?
Next week. So I'll get on the horn.
All right, but not to me directly. I don't take direct calls. I mean, you'll have to go.
I understand. I'll talk to your people.
Yeah, it gets very awkward. Brett Baer, thanks so much. Right. Brett Baer's coming to New York next week. Pick out an outfit, Brian. That's a mental note. Back in a moment.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
How many people have been indicted in your state right now? Do you know, Governor?
I don't have those numbers with me.
Don't? 98 people have been indicted. You'd happen to know how many are Somali American?
I don't. We prosecuted over 300 people in the Medicaid fraud area.
300, I would them. Predict we, is a drop in the bucket. But you've never said to stop payments. That's
it's one of the highest rates in the country, sir.
Well, you have one of the highest fraud rates in the country.
Your former chief of staff was notified directly by these various commissioners about the fraud in Minnesota.
That could be correct.
So are you saying that your chief of staff didn't notify you?
I'm saying I don't recall.
Oh, this governor is such an embarrassment. Can you imagine if he was actually vice president? That's Waltz and Keith Ellison, the AG, who just watched that criminal, all that money being wasted. And I think they're getting towards billions being sent over to Somalia in suitcases. That's what TSA agents said, because you turn it over. You're allowed to take cash out of the country, and they did. And guess where the money was supposed to go? To feed the homeless, feed those in need, and for autistic kids. They went into the Somali community and said, I don't care if your kid's autistic or not. If you bring them in, you can keep half the money, the grant money, and we take the other half. So right now, Jordan responded that they didn't want to answer the question. I don't really look at people's heritage or their ethnicity. Okay, that's fine. That's good for you. But you do have to notice some trends. 85% of the people indicted were Somali Americans. And I think that's what drove the whole thing. So if you see a problem, and they happen to be Somali, Nigerians, Irish, Italians, Norwegians, it's not racist, sexist, or xenophobic to say, hey, what's with that community? You know, all this money's being stolen in Little Italy in New York City. I don't know. Am I being anti-Italian by saying I think there's something within the Italian community and the money's flowing back to Italy? But no, everyone's scared to death or placating and pandering to the black community during that period, and they got found out. And the best thing that happened to them was the ICE controversy there, because people stopped talking about it and they started talking about ICE and not about the fraud. But that was front and center yesterday. Sadly, it happened in the afternoon and not enough people paid attention to it.
makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So we are back. We love when Frank Bisignano comes to visit us. He's run Social Security with the administration there and the CEO of the IRS, a powerful guy who didn't need this job. In fact, he did it as a favor to the country, the old-fashioned thing called service. And today is the 7th annual Slam the Scam Day. It's coming on March 5th, as you know. So each year, Americans lose hundreds of millions of dollars to fraudsters and their schemes, often impersonating government agencies. They might come in your email, you get all panicky, and you do what they say, and it turns out it's all a scam. It fuels criminal and trafficking networks, so we're going to focus on that. But also on the job, Frank, you've been able to do in just over a year, under a year, probably, because you had to have confirmation. Great to see you.
Good to be here. Always a pleasure for me.
So give everyone an idea of your background that led you to this moment and why you decided to take the job.
Well, first I grew up in a multi-generational immigrant household in Brooklyn, New York, which was, for me, the greatest place in the world. And I was fortunate to have a career that led me to great leaders. I worked for Sandy Weill, Jamie Dimon, Tony Terciano, Henry Kravitz, Scott Nuttall, all running large parts of J.P. Morgan, chief operating officer. On 9/11, I was in Lower Manhattan as the chief administrative officer with 16,000 people. 7 World Trade Center was a building. And I just was blessed in the bosses I had. And then, I get the opportunity to work for the president of the United States, and the blessing continues. So I was running a public company for 12 years, 48 quarters of earnings growth, an S&P 100 that served every American household. And I had an opportunity from the president to run Social Security for the country.
And a freedom not just to run it, but to change it.
To transform it. In the government, sometimes they use the phrase modernize. I use transformation. These are really technology agencies, technology businesses. If you look at Social Security, we have 330 million Americans with Social Security numbers. We're serving every one of them. Yes, we pay out over 70 million Americans of 1.5, 1.6 trillion a year. But we serve every American household. And then you have, so what we've done there is we've taken call wait times down. Proudest moment is in a couple weeks, we had transformed the website. It had 29 hours of downtime. It had service hours. And today it's up every day, 24 hours a day. We have over 100 million digital users. We've been driving that. While we're very dedicated to our field offices, and we've cut phone wait times from, in the last administration, there were 40 minutes on average, and they're single digits right now at peak season. All technology. I see the career leaders in the org so embraced in wanting this change.
So when you walked in there as the outside guy, they didn't resent you, push back and say, we have a way of doing things. Or
it took a while, but I've been through a lot of turnarounds. First Data was one of the great turnarounds when I took the mortgage company during the crisis. That was a great turnaround.
2008, it was called First Data.
I've got to 2000. It was First Data in 2013. I took that job, but when I took the mortgage business at J.P. Morgan Chase during the housing crisis, we turned it around and we restarted the housing market and. I ran the global transaction bank at Citigroup, which turned into its best run business. I'm proud of the people that took it after me. And it's always about getting people to understand culture, being one team, one dream. We're doing it at IRS right now. The team calls it One IRS, right? And everybody's working for each other, with each other.
They said that's very hard with civil servants. That's not the mindset. Am I wrong?
I think it requires a governance structure. Our governance structure looks like this for both orgs. A weekly staff meeting, normal, but maybe not normal for everybody. I never knew not having one in the beginning of the week. Once a month, an all-day management meeting to make sure everything we're doing is on track.
Wow, a whole day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And by the way, I learned that from Sandy Weil. I learned it from Jamie Dimon.
CEO of Citibank.
Yeah, when we were the biggest bank in the world and the best bank, and then J.P. Morgan was. So these are disciplines that those great leaders taught me that I've had the ability to bring into my own companies as a 12-year public company CEO and bring it to the government. We get together once a week and go through every key indicator with multiple levels of management. We have a risk meeting once a week to go through any risk-related items in what are the largest financial services businesses in the world, IRS and SSA.
So let's talk about some of the improvements you've made. When it comes to reimbursements, people are filing their taxes now, thinking about it, getting their paperwork together. If they get the April 15th as a deadline. But now you were just telling me, it's a 8 or 9 day turnaround on your refund?
Yeah, what we're doing right now is, first of all, to frame it, during tax season, which started on time, when there were a lot of pundits that were questioning it because of staffing levels, because of all the change. But of course,
because Elon Musk came in there and doged it before you kind of got there, right?
It was definitely before I got there. But the fact of the matter is, as I like to say, nobody said the staffing level we had was the right staffing level. And right now we're delivering single digits on the phones for Americans, right? And we're getting, as I said, direct deposits, which is the, you know, 90 plus percent of the payments out within an average of 9 days. I think when you look at this tax season, 40% of the people have already filed. We have 56 million filings already. Tax season's viewed as 140 million. And what's really important is 43% of the filings have a Schedule 1A. What's the Schedule 1A? It's a deduction from the Working Families Tax Act. So think about that.
Which is a big, beautiful bill.
Big, beautiful bill. The number one claim deduction on that is overtime. You want to talk about working families tax cut. Working families love overtime, and you see it going on now. And also what to recognize is,
and they get to keep it.
Yes.
So you also
have what probably will be the largest economic deduction, the benefit to seniors on Social Security.
So tell me about that, because it didn't go, you couldn't do it exactly like you wanted. He said, don't pay tax on Social Security. You couldn't do it exactly that way. So which way did he end up doing it?
Well, it ended up that it's up to $6,000 for an individual filer, up to $12,000 for a joint filer of a deduction. So, you know, that's all money back in those seniors' pockets.
Wow.
As the president, what he delivered and what the Congress ultimately delivered was probably the most landmark legislation and tax. We have bigger refunds going out. You know, we talked about $1,000 more on a refund. If you look at those who took that Schedule 1A, it's 775 right now, but our research and analytics group, and I sat with them the other day, have it going up to 1,000 because there's more returns coming in later.
Wow.
Very, very powerful, and I'm so proud of the organization, our technology organization, our servicing organization, because they're delivering. We have a national taxpayer advocate who actually is confirmed and reports. And they're advocating for taxpayers. I talked to her yesterday before the congressional hearing. I said, if I was to quote you, what would you say? Everything is going smoothly. And, you know, any issue we see is an anomaly of an individual. It's really been amazing work by the group.
It's going to be encouraging because we're going to know. We're going to know when you file your taxes, communication's great. What about the refunds? And we're going to see how this all goes, because the president says no one's felt the big, beautiful bill yet, because they really got to file their taxes first. And that's when.
Well, there's a double benefit here. Deductions are coming down. We made a lot of items. I say we liberally, led by the president, made a lot of items permanently, like a double standard deduction.
Right.
So in 26, right now, people are getting a bigger paycheck because of better deductions that occurred. A tax credit child tax credit. And then you see small businesses getting a 199A pass-through benefit. All of this made permanent. And so we're seeing more employers feeling that they have more money to spend. And that means more employment, and it means better opportunities and a growth in America.
I hear you. So yesterday you were testifying. Was it the first time you testified on Capitol Hill or after your confirmation?
No, I had been to House and Ways Means for Social Security for a hearing, and then yesterday it was the IRS.
What was it like?
It's always kind of fun, you know, three hours and 40 minutes. You know, I think, you know, Chairman Smith did a great job. People very enthused about the outcomes. I'd say on both sides of the aisle, it was well recognized that IRS is delivering. You know, the most powerful number I love is that 40% more online inquiries to us, meaning taxpayers self-serving. They could hit a button and say, where's my refund? And they could get an update. And when we talk about slam the scam, the best offense we have is people knowing where their money is and being in control of it. So with direct deposit and the ability to see where your money is, we've created that 40+% is 40 million times. What's happened? Phone volume has gone down. People are able to serve themselves in the manner right. they operate every day.
Frank Bisignano is here. He runs Social Security as well as the IRS. A few more minutes with him. I want to get some tips, if I can, Frank, on people listening out there on what scams to look for and how to know if it's really you, the Social Security, it's really the IRS. As opposed to some scammer out there, because these guys are getting better and better. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The headlines, the stories behind them, and the people who make them. Only on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. We are back. Frank Bisignano is here. He's a Social Security Administrator and CEO of the IRS. And Frank, you got your hands full. First off, I didn't talk to you about the Trump accounts yet. So out of how much money is in it and how many people have already signed up for the Trump accounts?
Well, you know, we have multiple things going on. We have 3 million dependents. We have 2 million Forms 45, 47. It's growing every day. It's growing every day. Remember, they don't start inception till July 4, 26, right? So you have Michael Dell and his family, God bless them, putting over $6 billion. That means $250 for every person who has a Trump account. We have about 750,000 of newborns, and then the rest are dependents. It is so early and so powerful. It's an IRA opportunity of a lifetime for Americans. So just in the infancy.
And 3 million people have signed up for it already for their kids.
Yes.
And is that, could you be a grandparent and sign up for it?
Yes, you can. Okay. Yes.
So you could be a grandparent and say, I want to put it for my 3 grandchildren.
Exactly.
Okay, and
in
then,
my case, my 5.
And in the ideal world, instead of people getting a gift for a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, they say, "I donated $200 to your account,
yes.
right, or more,
yeah.
or less."
Yes.
So
yes.
And that grows.
Yep.
And you can't touch it till you're 18.
18. But a deep belief is we're going to teach financial discipline. We all know that, you know, maybe a long time ago in my era, you had a passbook, and you went to the bank, and you may have been putting $5
in. Get there
in.
Before 3 o'clock.
Yeah, and that taught many people financial discipline. You know, the president's enactment of this is unparalleled, and the secretary's effort, Secretary Bessent, what he's doing is creating something that will be multi-generational.
I remember Kevin Hart had this talk, and he was trying to talk to kids in inner city. And he's trying to teach them that they could be part of the economy, part of investment. Because he said, for example, where do you shop? And he goes, where do you get that backpack? Well, I went to Walmart. I got that backpack. Okay. Do you want to buy a stock in Walmart? Yeah. Is that a good store? Yeah. Well, what would you want to buy a stock in it? Here's how to do it. Just to get people thinking like
100%.
That who don't have a dad like you, Frank, who did this for a living and maybe brought his friends home and they overheard it at the dinner table. You know, so you have that. And the other thing to keep in mind, is there anything you could offer people? And I get this all the time. And I know very smart people have fallen for it. The fraud.
Oh.
Sometimes it might be from Social Security. Sometimes it might be from the IRS. You get scared. You answer the questions. And next thing you know, you're hacked.
Well, this is National Consumer Protection Week. And, you know, across the government, led at SSA, it's Slam the Scam Day. Today is Slam the Scam Day. And our tips on this are quite simple. First and foremost, everybody should tell everybody to know the IRS or SSA is not going to threaten you, tell you something bad's going to happen if you don't hurry up and send us money, and a phone call's never going to ask for some personal identifiers. And the whole trick on the scammers is to put you in panic mode. You must do this now or something really bad's going to happen. And at that moment, you should just hang up the phone and report it. Right? That's Slam the Scam. We're partnering with the Inspector General, and we've had huge success. We want to protect our most vulnerable communities, right? That's where they go to, right? And in fact, we want everybody to always know you're never going to get a phone call from Social Security or IRS that says you have to hurry up. And go send us this money or we're shutting down your Social Security number.
I have an economic question for you.
Yes, sir.
I just read today, as well as J.P. Morgan Chase is doing, they're laying off a large number of people. And I'm wondering, you know the financial sector. These are all your friends, right? So what's going on there? Yet it seems to be a great time for bankers, but yet they should be adding to the roster. Is AI taking a bite of this?
Well, I think, you know, look at, you probably saw Block said they were going to cut the old Square, the payment company that I so happily competed against, half their workforce. Half their workforce. Now, they're saying
it's doing well.
AI.
But
it is, there is AI coming in. But in fact, you'd have to say, were people just over hiring over time? And AI is a potential crutch for exactly what to deal with. Yes, AI will bring the benefits. But, you know, I've always said through my whole career, technology is the great enabler. But I've really never seen technology not drive to more opportunity. So thus, employment still continues.
You're not worried
on.
About, for people listening to us right now who are a very, you know, college degree, should they worry about AI?
They should embrace it, figure out how to utilize it. I mean, I think, you know, I love the technology sector for people coming out of school. I love the finance sector for people coming out of school. I think if you look at any chart, you'll see them always having explosive growth. And, you know, historically, good performers in good companies
Go to Social Security or IRS because you got a great CEO. Frank Bisignano, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hello, I'm Brian Kilmeade. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a lot going on today. We come to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country and around the world. Sage Steele's going to be in studio, one of the most talented sportscasters. Now she does everything on her great podcast. Josh Krashauer brings us inside politics, and there's a lot to discuss. We're caught up in the war, and I get it. But we also have a lot of primary intrigue and a lot of, I thought, some upsets as well as some runoffs. I didn't think it was going to go that direction. And we'll take a look at that. So for now, before we get to Josh, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
How many people have been indicted in your state right now? Do you know, Governor?
I don't have those numbers with me.
But you've never said to stop payments.
It's one of the highest rates in the country, sir.
Well, you have one of the highest fraud rates in the country.
Yes, good point, James Comer, chairman of the Oversight Committee. That is a little of what is going on with all the scams that are happening right now in this country. Cost on the economy. We look at this war and the degree of the short-term pain and energy that America will be patient for. Also, the fraud front and center and scrutinies on Minnesota.
Number two.
This will definitely be temporary. The Trump administration's energy addition, energy dominance agenda have just massively grown global supplies of oil, natural gas. But yeah, are we going to have a transient bump up as we've seen in gasoline prices? We do a little bit.
Strait of Hormuz. The Iranians said, you can go through unless you're Americans or Israelis or Europeans. Not good enough to bring the price of oil down. We're going to discuss it.
Number one.
For the first time since 1945, a United States Navy fast attack submarine has sunk an enemy combatant ship using a single Mark 48 torpedo to achieve immediate effect, sending the warship to the bottom of the sea.
That is pretty impressive. General Dan Cain, U.S. and Israel ramp up targets in Iran, eliminating the Navy. Yep, the Navy, focusing on leadership and launchers. We have the latest as the pace of this war really picks up. It's not going to be a long one. Trump knows exactly what he's doing, even if they're not communicating it necessarily on one note. And a part of the reason is there's more than one reason to go after Iran. There's the history. There's the pace in which the talks were happening. There's rebuilding of the two nuclear sites that were blown up about 8 months ago. And there, of course, is the ballistic missiles, about 100 a month, thanks to China, that are going out and being expedited, along with the drone technology that's happening, as well as financing, supporting, energizing, planning, and plotting with Hamas and Hezbollah. And that's why when you talk to a Trump official, a lot of times they say, well, you got multiple reasons for the war. Which is it? How about all of it? With me right now is Josh Krasauer. Josh, welcome.
Hey, Brian, good to be back with you.
So yesterday, the Senate did not vote to stop the president from conducting this war. Not that it would have mattered anyway. And now the House. How do you think the House is going to go?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think there are two Republicans we're watching that may vote against the leadership. That's, as you know, Tom Massey in Kentucky, and Warren Davidson may also join him from Ohio. But, you know, it's looking like there actually will be maybe slightly more Democrats that break with their party. We already saw John Fetterman do so during the Senate vote yesterday. But Josh Gottheimer from New Jersey, Craig Landsman of Ohio have said that they're actually not going to be supporting party leadership. So, you know, you have a few within both parties going again. I mean, it's generally a party line vote. I will say, talking to a number of Democrats, moderate Tom Suozzi or Jared Moskowitz in Florida, and you know, a handful of others, there's a discomfort. They are 100% on board that Congress should authorize and play a role in helping ratify the foreign policy that Trump has set, agree or disagree, but they are supportive of the overall mission. And you saw that in some of the statements that came out in the immediate aftermath of the war, that you know, there was a united Democratic front against Trump not seeking congressional authorization, but a notable number of Democrats did speak out against the Iranian regime, the Ayatollah, and generally, you know, spoke in favor of the troops. Now, I still think that's a minority within the caucus, but there is a divide within the Democratic Party beyond just the authorization and whether they support the mission.
Yeah, I want you to hear what some critics have said, like Olivia Beavers from the Wall Street Journal. He says this is what the Democrats are telling her. Cut 20.
Democrats, as you can imagine, and as the Senate vote was, it was split. So they feel like the administration really wasn't giving them answers for their decision to launch what they've described as a defensive operation.
So the one thing that came out was Steve Witkoff sat down with Sean Hannity. That would have been better with one message, is that the Iranians told them when they first started talking to them again, they said, we got 460 kilograms of enriched uranium. We can make 11 bombs, and we're not going to do it. We're not giving that up. So they almost got up, you know, after that. And they dealt with him a couple more rounds, and he just told the president, nothing's changing. You know, it's gone from posturing to dug in. So that would have been, you bring that up, and, you know, I don't know what Oman was saying. They say, we're really making progress. You're not making progress. This is the same game they're always playing, and we cannot keep our troops and our assets for too long without using them. So it's either you're going to deal and we're going to pull out, or you're not going to deal and we're going to attack, and we're attacking.
Yeah, look, I think the process arguments is what unites the party. Now, the substance, now that we're at war, is where there's a little more debate. Look, anyone who paid attention to those negotiations in Oman and Geneva over the last few months knew that the Iran was not conceding one whit of anything that would have been significant. If there was actual progress, if they actually really were committed to giving up ballistic missiles or not enriching uranium and nuclear material, there actually may have been a deal. But Iran was buying time, posturing, doing what they do best. I mean, this was sort of their playbook during the Obama years. If you remember, you know, we cut a deal, which Trump pulled out of, but Iran was already, by the end of that deal, you know, not living up to its end of the bargain. So we know how the Iranians play these negotiations, and it was pretty much par for the course, and anyone paying attention knows that reality. Look, I think on the messaging front, the White House could, this is, you know, this is something that happens in a lot of administrations when they're, you know, when there's a lot of reasons to engage or go use force against an enemy. There are a lot of reasons. You can point to the nuclear pursuit. You can point to the fact they're sponsoring terrorist groups throughout the region, the destabilizing effect. But I will say that, you know, look, I think the Trump administration would have done done themselves a service if they actually kind of spent a little more time preparing the public, making the argument a little more in the State of the Union that Trump gave a few weeks ago, you know, preparing the public. I think the public is sort of catching up to a lot of the arguments, and they're still processing things as we go along.
Well, let me ask them, you know, Trump had such bad experience with the NSC, you know, Alexander Vindman linking out calls, the anonymous guy writing a book about him, and he never really trusted people listening on the line, didn't even know it. He's having world leaders' conversations leaked. It hasn't happened. Part of the reason is he doesn't want an NSC. He's like, I'm just going to deal with my group. You know, I'll keep Waltz informed in New York. I'll keep Rubio. He's got two jobs. And, you know, I got my vice president. And because of that, maybe, and of course the communications, White House communications, maybe, Josh, and you're the expert, you're there every day, maybe it would have been easier to make that message more coherent if they had the traditional NSC. Do you think I'm right about that?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's the danger of limiting your inner circle to a really trusted group of people. I mean, Marco Rubio has done, a tremendous job. He's really run point on a whole lot of fronts, but only one person can only do so much, and having allies, having a bigger bureaucracy that's able to communicate, able to work with allies, able to kind of work with the embassies to evacuate. These are things that having kind of that organization there ahead of time would have been helpful. You know, I think the White House would tell you that they also wanted the element of surprise. They wanted to, you know, catch Iran off guard, and they did during the daytime, where they were able to initially the initial strike against the Ayatollah and some of his top officials really hit the, you know, nailed at least several dozen of top IRGC and political officials in the country. So, you know, that's what. There was a little bit of misdirection, I think, too. But look, the State of the Union, that would have been, I mean, I know Trump did talk about Iran a little bit during the State of the Union. I would, given that speech went 2 hours, I would have, you know, had a foreign policy section and really laid out the threat historically and currently that Iran has posed and does pose. And I think it was a little all over the map in that section. I think that would have been the opportunity with tens of millions of Americans watching to really lay out the case. Instead, they've been playing a little bit of catch up in the interim.
Josh, you're the Fox News Radio political analyst and editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. So I noticed that these 2028 candidates, for the first time, they're going to be running against Israel. They're going to be running, I guess, afraid to have upset their anti-Semitic wing. And the Republicans have a portion of their party who's very anti-Israel. And Gavin Newsom, who changes like a weather vane, but the thing that drives him is what's hot politically. He said this, cut 24.
Do you think, looking down the road, that the United States should consider maybe, you know, rethinking our military support for Israel?
It breaks my heart because the current leadership in Israel is walking us down that path where I don't think you have a choice but that consideration.
Really?
Yeah, that was a real eyebrow raiser from Gavin Newsom. It wasn't just that comment, but he also at one point seemed to suggest that Israel was an apartheid
state. Let's let people hear that. Cut 23.
The issue of Bibi is interesting because he's got his own domestic issues. He's trying to stay out of jail. He's got an election coming up. He's potentially on the ropes. He's got folks, the hard line, that want to annex the West Bank. I mean, Freeman and others are talking about it appropriately, sort of an apartheid state.
What is that? Sounds like a Palestinian talking point.
Yeah, I mean, just in the last 2 weeks, Brian. I mean, Gavin Newsom was asked at an event whether he would take money from AIPAC, and he was sort of hemming and hawing, didn't say anything. He dodged the question. Then he ended up doing a do-over and attacked AIPAC, and ever since then, he's been going harder and harder against Israel as the Democratic Party has really just gone off the deep end in many ways. The mainstream wing of the party has been swamped by the activist wing, even during wartime, even during a time when Israel's a threat from Iranian missiles. And Iran is certainly threatening the security of the Jewish state. So, it is puzzling. I've talked to more Democrats in the last few weeks who have been shocked at the direction of their party and don't even know if they would call themselves Democrats anymore. Pro-Israel Democrats, Jewish Democrats, all across the board, moderate Democrats, they are shocked at the rhetoric coming from the leading 2028 presidential candidates. And Newsom was, as liberal as Newsom is, he had been, a pretty good ally of the Jewish community in California. He had good relationship. He'd never said anything like this before, but he's actually doing an interview with a podcaster in New Hampshire, one of the early primary states today, who has made some of the most obscene comments about Israel, including saying that they're a terrorist state. And he's doing a prominent interview in New Hampshire with this podcaster. I mean, so he's clearly playing to the very extreme left. It's where a lot of the activists are demanding the party goes. And it's going to make things awfully uncomfortable in the months to come. In a primary, that may play okay. I mean, that's the way the Democratic Party seems to be going. This is toxic for swing voters, for persuadable voters. When you're softer on Iran than you are with one of the closest U.S. allies in Israel.
But Josh, the thing is, what worries me is even Josh Shapiro is not as fervent pro-Israel. And Trump is out there, but I don't know. I don't think J.D. Vance is as pro-Israel as Trump. So I'm worried about that relationship. And if I'm Netanyahu, I knock out all my enemies right away now, because this might be your last chance under Trump to do it.
I think there's something to that. I mean, the tide is pretty clear now. On the Republican side, you could only name one or two elected officials on the Republican side in Congress that are anti-Israel. It's Vance's office, perhaps, and it's the social media wing of the party. I think there's a lot to worry about among younger, conservatives and in the future. But right now, the elected officials are pretty much strongly supportive. On the Democratic side, we saw those early kind of early seeds being planted 5-6 years ago, and now the party is, reminds me of when Republicans were speaking out against Ukraine. There was not many Republicans. It started out with a small number, yep. And then there was the faction of it. And that's not. I would argue right now that there are more, Democrats that are anti-Israel than there were ever Republicans that were, against Ukraine during the war.
Yep.
As it goes on.
So I
know. That's a sign that the horseshoe theory, that the far left and the far right finding common cause, but it's kind of shocking how fast that has accelerated.
I don't want to give the name out because I don't want to get them more credit or clicks, but one prominent podcaster just said, we all know Israel's behind 9/11. I mean, that's where this is going. The Rosie O'Donnell whack job stuff. So I'm just, my jaw has been on the ground on this issue really since October 7th, 2023. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, given the online ecosystem, these conspiracy theories, these radical extreme views spread faster and get seen faster than ever before. When you look at polls and you ask normal people like what they think, these are still fringe views. So the fact that you saw this in 2020, Democrats chased all these fringe views that was online, it was percolating online about all these different woke issues and activist issues, and then they realized that no one really supported them. And then you had literally everyone marching off the cliff. I guess it was Joe Biden who was the only one that kind of held the line. And, reality intervened. So I think you're seeing a similar dynamic where Democrats think because they're online so much, everyone's anti-Israel. Well, the reality is even the most pessimistic polls show the public is pretty evenly divided in their view of Israel. Democrats have certainly moved in one direction. But this rhetoric about, Israel being a terrorist state, the kind of nonsense that just is so ludicrous on its face, that's the kind of stuff that's going to get the Democrats in trouble if they continue to pander to that.
Right, and also the Republicans, the extreme right on the Republican side, I find equally, because I expect more, equally as disturbing. But not between me and you. We're on the same page. Josh, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
Back in a moment.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. I didn't think the pain from the shingles rash would affect simple, everyday tasks like bathing, getting dressed, or even walking around. I was wrong. Though not everyone at risk will develop it, 99% of people over the age of 50 already have the virus that causes shingles, and it could reactivate at any time. I developed it, and the blistering rash lasted for weeks. Don't learn the hard way, like I did. Talk to your doctor or pharmacist today. Sponsored by GSK.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Our southern border should be like our front porch. There should be a giant welcome mat out front.
There are many more than two biological sexes. In fact, there are six.
God is both masculine and feminine and everything in between. God is non-binary.
So help me out here. We have some great affiliates in Texas. Is that the type of guy that you want representing the people of Texas? That is the idol of Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Kimmel and those on the left that's supposed to deliver a Democrat that's supposed to flip the seat, beat Cornyn or Ken Paxton. That is James Tallarico. He just beat Crockett, who was in tears, blaming Republicans for losing to a Democrat in a Democrat primary. Good luck. That made no sense. But Tallarico, I think he's got some issues, big time. And I think more stuff is going to come out on him. Here's Tallarico on changing politics and Crockett going after Republicans. This is what he had to say, cut 48.
We are not just trying to win an election. We are trying to fundamentally change our politics.
I can tell you now that people have been disenfranchised. This is what Republicans like to do.
What do Republicans have to do with the Democratic primary? She's upset about the way Democrats ran their primary in Dallas. And you're blaming, and she cried, you lost. And she called up, she called the guy and said, congratulations. But soon, she'll be out. And I think the best idea for her is The View. Something that would just listen to her and they can clap after things she says. Because as a politician, she's useless. She's theatrical, that's it. Just like Congresswoman Boebert and others, they're not there to make a difference. They're there to get famous. And she's one of the worst, by far. And by the way, who told her it would be a good idea to run? I would have just tried to keep her seat, even redistricting or not. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Back in the morning.
Talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, with me right now is Sage Steele. How do I know? I've met her in person and she looks exactly the same. She's got a great podcast called The Sage Steele Show. And when she comes here, she steals the show. Because everyone
wow.
loves you and looks to book you. And thanks so much for coming in, Sage.
I love hanging with you, though. No
right.
offense to everybody else.
Was I the first Fox
yes.
person? I was,
yes.
right? Okay.
Yes, right after I left ESPN. I remember being so nervous to meet you.
Right.
And you're not scary.
I'm really not scary?
No,
well,
sorry.
Allison deserves the credit for that, right, Allison? Because you realized when you were finally a free agent, you did your first interview with Megyn Kelly?
Yeah, 48 hours later, pretty raw.
Yeah.
That was... I think back about that time, and that was August of 23.
Wow.
And we became friends because we had the same attorney that she dealt yeah. with that helped her after her NBC fiasco, and then me with ESPN with Brian Friedman. He's also with Justin Baldoni right now. Like the guy is a genius, frankly. And so that's how Megan and I met, and she had me on. And from there, who knew that I'd be allowed in this building at some point too?
Well, absolutely. And now you're on with Sean all the time.
Yeah.
You're on with Jesse all the time.
Jesse, yeah.
So, and how's the podcast world going?
It's going well. Brian, yeah. this whole thing is a thing that I had wanted no part of.
Mm-hmm.
And now here we are. I love it. I think it's taken me a minute to fully appreciate the freedom with it. Mm-hmm. And when all you know is 30 years of network, local,
in and
regional,
out of eight
national.
Minutes. Get it done, right?
Yes. And directives and 64 bosses. Like, it's so weird to be able to say, you know what? I would be honored if I could talk to Brian Kilmeade on my show, which is going to happen.
Yes.
And so that freedom and to talk about whatever you want and to have an opinion that I believe should be based in fact, right? But to go out there and say what you want and not be afraid of what your employer's going to. I used to get pulled in and asked about, well, you know, why are you liking this person's tweets? We're noticing this. It's like, what? So the freedom part of it is amazing. I'm not a great entrepreneur. I've never done that. I had no interest. My husband fortunately is and is helping with that side of it. And he's done that his whole life. But it's a blessing. There's so many blessings that come with getting canceled. Who knew? Who knew?
Well, don't you think the canceled era is virtually over?
I feel like it, but they're hanging on. They don't want to let go of it, you know? But what happens is that when people, like, I hate to sound dramatic, but you rise from the ashes. When you believe that you were worthless, actually, you're like, oh my gosh, everybody's crashing on me, that this must be true. And then you wake up the next day and you're still breathing. And then you're like, wow, I can actually walk and talk too. When you do that, others who've lived in fear of speaking up realize, well, maybe I need to do this too. Maybe it's my time, because if they survived it, then I can too. And that is one of the reasons why I think now, the cancel culture era is going away quickly, not quickly enough in my mind, compared to what so many people have been through. But courage begets courage. And I never looked at my thing as courage. It was just standing up for what I thought was right. But Riley Gaines talks about that all the time. And courage begets courage. And when you speak, look at all these other young women athletes who are now stepping up and saying, no, I shouldn't have to be in a locker room with a boy. This is sick. But I don't know that that would have happened if not for some of those young women like Riley.
Well, look at Megan Rapinoe. This is to your point, not mine. She is still ripping on everything that doesn't say that there are two, there are seven genders, and that men should be able to play on the women's national team. I guess, what would that do to her?
Well, she, you know, I had so much respect for her, and I would like to separate that as a player, right? But otherwise, and I try not to personalize it, but she disgusts me. Because what she has done has been strategic, and maybe she believes this the whole time. Maybe she's just virtue signaling. I don't know. I think she believes it. But to wait until the end of your career, when you've got millions of dollars in your pocket, to then all of a sudden say, yeah, it's fine. And all you anti-trans racist, what, like the stuff that she's called me and many other people.
I didn't know she attacked you.
Oh, she did. She did it with me, Dave Chappelle, and someone else in the same sentence, and how we are a danger to the trans community with what we say, that women's spaces should be protected. And it is just so convenient and sick that she waits to the end. Because remember when the women's national team lost to, I think it was an under 15 boys team from Texas, like high school kids. And there's no shame. Guess what? Men are different from women. Newsflash, news bulletin, right? And so she knows she would never have had the career that she had, the illustrious career, if men had been in her sport. So she's full of it. She disgusts me, and she's doing such a disservice to so many millions of young women and girls who've looked up to her this entire time.
But I think, you know what? I saw her in Dunkin' Donuts ads a few years ago. I don't see her now. Also, the way her career ended was so bizarre. She misses a penalty kick.
Yeah.
And she's like, is this a bad joke? No, you missed a penalty kick. It's not a bad. It's called the way it happens in sports. You don't always win a championship. You don't always score the goal. And they blew that whole tournament because those women, totally unlikable, by the way.
Now they are,
and you're talking about somebody that was there in 93. I watched Mia Hamm and Julie Foudy and Christine Lilly and all those. I covered Brianna Scurry in goal. And, of course, they win the World Cup in front of 100,000 in Pasadena. I was there. Bill Clinton went to the locker room and he partied with the girls.
What a concept.
Yeah. But there was no cameras, so he didn't get any blowback from it like this president.
I don't think he would have.
But this last one, the new one, are great. I don't know about them personally, but professionally, the new era seems to be good. But the last one that just left, I could do without.
Yeah, and listen, some of the young women in the NWSL right now are doing some of the same things Megan is doing. And I've got the name of their teammate who was out on one of the teams in California.
So the Professional Women's League.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the Professional Women's League. And who just said, listen, I'm sorry, trans women /men, do not belong in our spaces. And what did her teammates do? They came out and they attacked her and they held a press conference. Like, it's insanity. So unfortunately, that's the point about Rapinoe and people like that. The impact actually runs deep. Yes, common sense should prevail. But when you are a legend like Rapinoe was on the pitch, she does have that influence. And you know, I mean, she's very much involved. I think she's one of the owners of Angel City or one of those teams. So it does matter what she says. But I do love that more and more people are now telling her where to shove it, frankly, because it's just factually incorrect.
So I coached a couple of players that are in the MLS right now, and they're brothers. And I asked to go out to this MLS team. I go, wouldn't it be good to do a feature? And they say, Brian, would it be, maybe you do it where they're having Thanksgiving and they go to practice the next day and they see where they've been and be, do a nice feature. You, yeah. So many different ways. And that team said, I don't really think we want to be on Fox. So for the MLS to turn down a national audience, even though that they don't have a national audience.
They need an audience.
Unless you're Messi. When Messi plays, it's different.
It's different.
Yeah.
And he's not American. I mean, you're still trying to grow the sport, and that's the decision that you make.
I've never heard of that before.
It's insane. And this is not about sports, but it reminds me, leading up to the election, I was... on the campaign trail, something I said I also would never do. And I remember, Brian, going with Laura Trump and Tulsi Gabbard and Danica Patrick and so many of these people. And we were like...
Having a great time. Sounds like a great time.
It was a blast with our pink jackets, Women for Trump. Point is, I was shocked to see that we were going to food pantries in Atlanta and Charlotte. And we'd go up for the day and help and unload the food that was being donated by the, you know, Trump Dole, all so many. Yeah, so many. It doesn't matter where it's coming from. It's free food for your community. Do you know that it took in Atlanta the first stop? The fourth one that we called who was willing to accept free food for the pantry in the community, because why? It was associated with Trump. So don't tell me you care about your communities when you're turning down free food and resources for poor people in Atlanta and Charlotte just because it had Trump's name associated with it. Problem is, so it's everywhere throughout culture, sports, you name it, where people just run away from it instead of saying, okay, let's look past the politics of it and the good of it. We're trying to promote soccer, for God's sake.
But the one thing I do get, and comedians know this too, that sometimes if you say, hey, as long as it's not politics, because you don't want to, you don't really, if they don't want to, you want to do a feature on the team, you want to make sure that stadium's packed. So unless they're signed, unless the player insists on it, if they say to me, Brian, don't bring up politics, I go, I wouldn't. This is about them, what they achieved and their family. But that I understand. If I'm media relations, And unless that player just says, no, I want to talk about it. Like, for example, Phil Mickelson, he comes up to me, I'm doing this event for his, for Liv. Mm-hmm. And I'm at the Doral Golf Club of Donald Trump.
Miami, yep.
Yeah, so he's my last interview. I can't wait to talk to him. He's so opinionated. And before he walk up, they go, oh, I just got to tell you, whatever you do, don't bring up politics. I go, all right, I got like two or three things to talk about. Why he left California, how he feels now.
Exactly. So, things he's been very public about himself.
So I'm thinking to myself, they went out of their way to say it. I'm like, should I do it? So I go, okay, it's a morning show. I won't talk about politics. You have plenty to talk about. We're done. And then afterwards, he says to me, oh, I would have talked to you. He goes, I just thought you were going to bring up stuff about politics. I would have talked about anything. So the media relations people got ahead and told me.
Publicists.
But that's why you always got to talk to the athlete or the coach first. But
And it stinks, but they're the ones. And how about if they're concerned, they ask Phil first. Don't speak for Phil.
Oh, I'd be furious if I'm Phil Mickelson.
Absolutely, because now, I mean, he is more vocal than ever.
Yeah, because he got ripped for saying, I'm going to move out of California because taxes are too high. Can you imagine that? Who would it? Now that everybody's moving out of California.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I think there's so many athletes who want to speak up, and it's just like the prior conversation. Like, the more who do it in a sane, factually based way that represents their opinion, there's nothing wrong with that. That's actually what we need more of. It's the way that you do it. If you're tearing down others when you do it, okay, fine. Yeah. But he's allowed to have an opinion.
So let's talk about hockey. And I know it seems like two lifetimes ago because we're in the middle of a war.
Yeah.
But the USA hockey team wins, gets a call from the president. Whether the FBI director should have been partying or not, that's a separate conversation. But he's a huge hockey guy. We also know people, very professional. You put them around an athlete or a sport, you know, they go crazy.
Oh, they do.
They're human. He goes to, he has Islander season ticket holders, goes to the game. So Cash Patel, that's a separate argument. But to have the president on speakerphone when you know that George Allen was called into Nixon, we used to give George Allen plays for the Redskins, Gerald Ford, this used to be Ronald Reagan was the biggest sports fan ever.
Yeah.
And that's controversial. And then the so-called joke, the president said, you know, I got to invite the women. How do you feel about that whole thing?
I just hate our media for this reason. It's like these guys who were as classy and have been since then, is classy and patriotic.
Hockey players are, though, right?
They're the best. When people ask me who are your favorite athletes to interview over a 30-year sports career, it is always hockey players. Always. Yeah. NHL first. And then we can debate from there. Football, basketball, baseball was always the toughest, frankly. I love these guys. They're
baseball,
so humble.
Baseball, so you said baseball?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Major League Baseball. I think it's because they have 162 games. They're like, leave me alone. I get it. But hockey guys are always so grateful and so, so humble. Listen, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter who the commander-in-chief is. The commander-in-chief is calling.
Yeah.
And always happens, for the most part, right? Whenever there's a championship of any kind won, I love how they handled it. They knew it was a joke. They laughed. And they're like, yeah, like we doubled up. We're two for two. Like, no one cared until certain people told us we should care. The Cash Patel thing, I prefer to not see him in there. I think he's busier these days. And you go to the game, do we need to be in there? Fine. But there's nothing wrong with the President of the United States calling to congratulate you and to invite you. I think it's a missed opportunity for the women. Sounds like they are going to eventually go. But I love how these guys have handled it ever since, with every single media pundit trying to get them to say Donald Trump should have said
that. And the whole
thing,
Sage Steele, our guest, says the whole thing is they can't drive a wedge between two teams that pulled for each other, that trained with each other, that were in the same, hotel or dorm, whatever it was, but they went to each other's games. So when you have the men did this and the women did this, they said, well, we have no friction. We have no problem. So don't make it up.
Jack Hughes said, the one who scored the game-winning goal, he said that the one who scored the women's game-winning goal, also a 2-1 game in overtime, that
against
she inspired
Canada.
Him. Against get right. She inspired him. Like, there's so much love between these two, and so I think it's pathetic, and it would never have happened had this been under Joe Biden or Barack Obama or even George Bush. It's a different time, a different era, but people want to find any reason to hate more on Donald Trump, and the best thing is most of those guys said, I don't care. I'm going to the White House. Because it's the White House and because we won this for America.
Yeah, and we had a chance to meet them, and they especially like this president. I noted, hey, if we can, here's Charles Barkley talking about this whole incident.
Everything is not Democrat, Republican, conservative, or liberal. That's why we got this divided, screwed up country. I'm not a Trump guy. But if I got invited to the White House, I would go. I'm not a Trump guy. I want to make that clear. But I respect the office. He's the president of the United States.
So
simple.
Makes sense.
But then you look at the contrast of that with like a Steve Kerr and a Doc Rivers and a Greg Popovich. And it's just
the worst.
He's the worst. But now he's kind of gone and you pray for him. His health is a thing. Doc Rivers is the worst. The DMs he has sent me. Crushing me for my beliefs. Like it's
right at you.
I was like, Doc, remember that whole thing, diversity of thought. It's not just diversity of skin color, which is you guys always want to make it about race, but it's Doc and who used to be a friend of mine and Steve Kerr, etc., who want, you know, they lead with divisiveness and hatred and judgment. Because I actually said to Doc, you know, this is a very long DM chain, and I was like, you just hate the fact that you can't, you know, put me in a box because of my skin color. I'm supposed to think a certain way and vote a certain way and marry a certain way. You, people like you and Steve Kerr, are the problem. How about respecting people's opinions? You don't know my story. You don't know my why. And I don't know yours. I respect yours. Why are you coming? So I have no respect for those guys who are in such leadership positions. And when they make their basketball press conferences about this, stop. That is not. I tell this to my bosses, Brian. Why are we bringing politics into sports and Sports Center? It's not why people watch us.
Right. Steve Kerr, by the way, didn't his dad die in Beirut?
Yes.
By Iranian sponsored and supported Hezbollah, who blew up, killed 241 Americans back in 1983. His dad was one of them.
His dad was. And it's heartbreaking. And people say, well, that's why his opinions. I'm like, again, it isn't necessarily what your opinion is. It's the way you choose to
condemn others for having a differing opinion.
Condemn. That is the opposite of what you people preach.
That was a perfect way to go to break. So we will.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Oh, are we just finding out Britney Spears was arrested? Chloe,
a dancing.
DUI? She's driving herself? Whose idea was that?
Oh,
I mean, Sage Steele,
the dancing videos is what she should be arrested for.
So, Sage, you're in the news.
Did
CBS try to hire
you? Oh, my gosh. I am so glad you're asking this question.
Okay.
Brian, I literally heard nothing about any of this. I had a reporter reach out 48 hours ago on my info at thing.
Yeah.
And I laughed. I was like, this is some guy trying to, I have no idea what this is. And then yesterday I'm on the flight coming here to New York, and a friend sends me all these links to Sage Steele. I was like, what? Not a single human being has ever reached out to me from CBS, from anywhere. So, like,
it says they tried, so no, to know.
No. I look through emails to make sure. I'm like, not one person. You know what they did? This is what happens all the time in the media business. They threw a name out of a former host who, I don't know, has the same skin color as Gayle King. I don't know. And it's like, threw me out there to
manipulate and make it seem.
And I was actually kind of upset. I'm like, wait, I'm kind of easy to find. Pick up the phone, if that's the case. But I actually don't think they wanted to talk to me. This was just
Do you know her?
Who?
Barry Weiss?
Never met her.
Yeah.
Never talked to her.
I like the free press.
I mean, I guess so. That's why I need to look at it. But, and I've certainly respected her and what she inspired me with what she did, leaving this part of the world, now coming back. But I swear to you, thank you for asking. You're the first person to ask.
And that's
I had zero clue.
The Sage Steele Show, where do we get your podcast?
YouTube, and everywhere you can find it.
Everywhere else. We're on YouTube too. But you were there first. All right. Thanks so much, Sage.
Appreciate it.
All right. Don't go anywhere.
News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a lot on the agenda today. We're following the latest on the war. The Secretary of War, as well as the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff visiting CENTCOM in Tampa. They gave some remarks. We'll bring back some of them. Bottom line, it's going really well, and the pace is only going to pick up. Why? We opened up the skies, and it looks like we basically have freedom. Although, I do worry because the Defense of Democracy stats show that the Iranians have about 2,000 rockets, and they've only set off about 700. So I'm wondering if they're pacing themselves, but I'm sure the military knows much more than me. Carl Rove is standing by. Ari Sacher, an Israeli rocket scientist with 3 decades of experience on anti-missile technology, is going to be here, including the Iron Dome, help construct it. So before we get to Carl, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
How many people have been indicted in your state right now? Do you know, Governor?
I don't have those numbers with me.
But you've never said to stop payments.
It's one of the highest rates in the country, sir.
Well, you have one of the highest fraud rates in the country.
That is some of the exchange on the fraud trials yesterday. I just feel as this governor, attorney general, enough about the embarrassment. I need to know. Get the whistleblowers to talk about how they were informed, what you have said, and why they looked the other way. It has a lot to do with being politically correct, not caring, and using the Somali influence on their elections.
Number two.
This will definitely be temporary. The Trump administration's energy addition, energy dominance agenda have just massively grown global supplies of oil, natural gas. But yeah, are we going to have a transient bump up as we've seen in gasoline prices? We do a little bit.
Cost on the economy. We look at the war and the degree of the short-term pain on energy. Will America be patient or make Trump pay the price?
Number one.
For the first time since 1945, a United States Navy fast attack submarine has sunk an enemy combatant ship using a single Mark 48 torpedo to achieve immediate effect, sending the warship to the bottom of the sea.
General Kane really outlining some fantastic performances by our military. U.S. and Israel ramp up targets in Iran, eliminating their Navy. Their Navy focusing on leadership and launchers. We have the latest. Carl, it's almost as if it's back to the future for you. A lot of your time in the White House was you guys were at war right after 9/11. How does this feel the same?
Well, it feels the same in part because, you know, we had to deal in Iraq and Afghanistan with the malign influence of the Iranians. I mean, we've been at war with them. They've been at war with us for 47 years, even at the moments that we haven't acknowledged it. And so, you know, and again, grabbing control of the skies was critical in both Iraq and in Afghanistan. It was easier to do, obviously, in Afghanistan because the Taliban had virtually no modern air force. But this is an extraordinary performance by the U.S. and Israeli militaries, and the degradation of the Iranian capabilities last year is showed up this year, and they've been further degraded. I mean, essentially, their navy's wiped out, their air force is in the process of being wiped out, their military depots are being blown, their missile fabrication facilities, their launchers, their drone facilities, all of these are at risk for them.
So, Carl, Condoleezza Rice, your good friend, former Secretary of State, was on with Brett last night, also a good friend of yours. Here's what she said. She sees the justification for this, and to me, wanted everyone to understand the history, to understand fully why we're there. Cut seven.
If you can render Iran essentially incapable of military action against us and against our allies, that's worthy. And I think what they're trying to do is to neuter Iran as a military power in the region. And by the way, the Iranians, who I think made a strategic blunder in attacking the Gulf states like the UAE or Kuwait or others, is demonstrating that it is its goal to be a destabilizing force in the Middle East. Yes, you can still be concerned about what may come after. You can still be concerned about the uncertainties of warfare. But to render this awful regime incapable of using its military power, that's a worthy goal.
And that's what's got to be outlined. And I think you got to hear that from Tom Cotton. You got to hear that from Lindsey Graham. You got to hear that from the president, the vice president. Well, don't you agree, Marco Rubio?
Yeah, in fact, I wrote my column about it in the Wall Street Journal today. I mean, look, the military execution has been superb, but the American people need to be told why we did this, what the stakes are, what is going on. It was great to have Kane out there briefing, but look, the president needs to consider giving an Oval Office address. And they need to have a deliberate plan to explain to the American people at the highest levels. Can't leave it just to the Sunday morning programs. I mean, those are, Tom Cotton, we had
Michael Waltz.
We had Mike Turner, the former intel chief.
He was great.
We had Senator Cruz. They were all good. But look, it is the president, and the president needs to lay this out and continually talk about it. So in a way that the American people can grasp, and otherwise support for this is going to diminish. And this is an important. This will affect the future not only of that region, but the security of the United States for decades to come.
So, Carl. And think about this for a second. I remember Gerald Ford. Tell me if you remember this. He said he knew Iraq was a problem. And he said, right. I don't know why the Bush administration just said weapons of mass destruction. They did so many other things worthy of right. this type of weapons inspectors, oil for food program. You should have had right. more than one reason. So when the war wasn't as, let's say, as predictable as we thought, and we know Iran had a lot to do with that. When it wasn't as predictable as we thought, they say, well, where are the weapons of mass destruction? And it looks, oh, he lied. And we know he never lied. We understand that. But if you gave the bunch of reasons why we were there, you wouldn't have been stuck to one. And in a way, I'm not saying that they took a page from this. You want to know why we're in Iran? Where do you want to start? The 83 barracks, the 79 hostages? How about the 603 that died during the Iraq war directly from the EFPs that they engineered and pushed? How about the 241 Marines that died in Beirut? How about the daily, how about the assassination attempt? Pick one, circle it. So if you just say one, then people go, okay, what about that? So go ahead. It's not just a nuclear program.
Yeah, you're right. Keep going. I mean, look, the nuclear program, the ballistic missile, they're attempting to build missiles that can hit the United States of America. And look, you talk about periodically they have closed the Strait of Hormuz, driving up oil prices around the world in order to discombobulate our economy and that of our allies. So, I mean, and they funded, look, the Houthis, Hezbollah. I mean, these are people who have been actively supporting Islamic radical terrorist movements around the world. So, but my point is my column was the White House needs to pay careful attention to this. And it's one thing to send out, articulate spokesmen like Cotton and Cruz on Sunday morning talk programs. But the White House needs to be behind this each and every day in a patient program of explaining to the American people the stakes and the consequences.
Yeah, the one thing that they've not looked at, they've kind of disabled, and the NSC, because of Alexander Vindman and some other leaks, that guy Anonymous who wrote the book, he does not trust these people in the State Department and elsewhere listening in on his phone calls, you know, the anti-Trumpers that were everywhere. And there used to be the NSC, and you know how it works. But the way I understand it works is the NSC used to get the White House communications along with the State Department communications and Defense Department communications, now the Department of War, and say, this is the message, this is the result, this is what we want to get out. But there doesn't seem to be that huddle around, no. And we need that huddle again, which you can make up your right. own huddle, but there's got to be a huddle. Right.
Yeah, that's right. I think that you're absolutely right. And look, Secretary of State Marco Rubio is doing a terrific job, but you need a national security advisor who could work with him as a force multiplier. Let me talk about one other thing that is critical. We need to be talking to the Iranian people. And one of the biggest mistakes the administration made, and I hold Carrie Lake responsible for it, was shutting down Radio Farsi. We had a radio service.
Oh, by the way, I found out that's not true. It's still there. So Jennifer Griffin corrected that.
Yeah, but its staff has been decimated. Its broadcasting is weak. It is not on as often as it was, and it's understaffed. And as a result, and we were also on the internet. We had a fulsome, all-out social media and radio program to communicate with the Iranian people, and it doesn't exist in the form that it used, the powerful form that it used to be there. Now, I'm a little bit wired up about this because I used to be on the board for international broadcasting that oversaw Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty and the radio services around the world that allowed people who live in closed societies like Iran to hear the truth. And this is a powerful tool that could be spreading the news about what is happening in their country that they're not hearing from their government. And we are weak in this regard, and we need to do more.
Well, Carl, let me ask you, was there a problem with the left-wing messaging that I watch on CNN International, and I'm able to pick up with a lot of these?
This was not CNN. This was not CNN.
No, I know, but was there a left-wing bias to it?
Look, when I was on the board, were there people who were Democrats and Republicans and liberals and conservatives? Yes, but you have editors and you have leadership, and so you can control that. If it is, particularly if we're talking about Iran, yes, if you're worried about it, have a couple of supervisors from the White House or the State Department over there looking at this material. But no, right. We should not have dismantled this enormous influence for us. If there were weaknesses, correct them. If there were mistakes, stop them. If there were voices that should be heard and voices that shouldn't be heard, make changes. But don't silence or undercut or gut, gotcha. Which is exactly what we've done to all these radio services.
I want to talk about Texas. James Tallarico is the new Beto O'Rourke. He's a genius. He's a fresh breath
Please,
of fresh air.
Let me stop you right there.
Can we listen to a little?
Let me stop you right there.
You want to listen to a little of it?
No. He is the next iteration of Robert Francis O'Rourke. Do not give Robert Francis O'Rourke the benefit of the phony nickname to appeal to Latino voters.
So listen to this. Cut 42.
Our southern border should be like our front porch. There should be a giant welcome mat out front.
There are many more than two biological sexes. In fact, there are six.
God is both masculine and feminine and everything in between.
Is Texas
God is non-binary?
Really? Okay. Do Texans believe that?
No. And look, this is I love it. It's like, yes, let's come up with a guy who says, unlike most Democrat candidates, I'm proud to be a Christian. But you know, the comment about six sexes was when he was opposing a bill that said men should not participate in women's sports. And this guy defended the principle by saying, well, you know, really, there are six sexes, and so we shouldn't get into this. And anybody ought to be able to participate in women's sports who wants to. So let's not kid ourselves. This guy, look, he is an Austin liberal. I live in Austin. I love Austin. But it is the blueberry in the deep red sea of Texas. And this guy is an Austin liberal, which means he does things like say, we ought to have a welcoming porch on our southern border and wring our hands over, anybody that the cartel is able to extract money from, we ought to welcome them across our border. You know, human traffickers are bad if they're in the U.S., but they're okay if they're in Mexico sending people across our border. I mean, this guy, John Cornyn, will do to him what he has done to every other person who's run against him, which is beat him badly.
Yeah, Carl, why does the turnout so low for Republicans in the primary?
Wait a minute, buddy. How low were they?
Lower than Democrats.
Yeah, but guess what? That happened in 2008. That happened in 2016. It happened in 2020. And the Republicans won the state overwhelming. The last time that it happened in a midterm election was 2002. And in that election, the Democrats had 900,000 people vote. The Republicans had 600,000 people vote. The Democrats nominated the mayor of Dallas, Ron Kirk, who was a serious candidate. And what happened? John Cornyn beat him 55-43. And so, yeah, look, most of the time, you know, the Texas primary and presidential election years, by the time we get to the time of our primary, traditionally, the Democrats still had a contest and we'd settled ours. But in this one, it was obviously not a presidential election year. And the Democrats had a couple hundred thousand more people vote than the Republicans.
So you're not worried about it.
No, I'm not worried about it.
All right, real quick, I got one exit question for you. The President of the United States said in a little while, I'm going to pick who I want to endorse in the Texas primary to be the Republican nominee, and I'm going to ask the other person to drop out. Is it too late?
Well, I don't, you know, already Ken Paxton has said, I'm not going to drop out. But look, I mean, the president's endorsement of John Cornyn will be dispositive and the contest will be over. And remember, think about this. A year ago, Cornyn was down by double digits.
Yep.
He was down almost 20 points. And he won. He came in first. And not only that, but in the last week of the campaign, Paxton was going around the state cocky, saying, I'm going to win by 20 to 30 points and win without a runoff. And on election night, he looked like death warmed over. I mean, he came within 900 votes out of nearly 100,000 votes of losing his home county of Collin County. The people who sent him to the state house and the state senate, who know him best and are taking sides on the divorce where his wife is divorcing him for biblical reasons, catch my drift, three girlfriends that we know of, you know, the people who knew him best almost turned him down in favor of Cornyn. Cornyn, on the other hand, won his home county of Bear, San Antonio, by a hefty margin.
All right, so you think if Trump endorses Cornyn, it just gets him the victory, or he's going to win anyway?
I think it absolutely guarantees him the victory.
Okay.
The president's endorsement is powerful.
All right, Carl, I like the fact that we zoomed together. I think it makes us even better, more synergy.
Yeah, I love
when you yell at
me. Smiling face. You're a handsome dude, and I get to yell at you.
I was trying to tell people that they're just not buying it. There you go.
Yeah.
Carl, thanks so much. Back in a moment.
Thanks.
You got it.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The people of Minnesota have been singled out and targeted for political retribution at an unparalleled scale, including blocking Medicaid reimbursements to our state just last week. I want your help on fraud. Why would I not want money to go to the programs I care deeply about, feeding people, clothing people, housing people? But what ICE did disrupted everything that we were doing. It disrupted our federal partners, and it forced our law enforcement agencies, who have worked hard to gain the public trust, to have the public believe in them.
So that is Governor Walz. Nice little speech. Problem is, his actions didn't back it up. There was no vigilance in doing it. And we all know the attorney general caught on tape making it clear to the Feed America people who took millions and people in jail because of it that, hey, listen, we'll look out for you. You look out for us. And they said, great. And that's essentially, you vote for us and you can take as much money as you want. We all know that. So I just think that this guy's got to pay the price. Either he's the bigger idiot than I think he is, just a total moron, or he looked the other way. And you know, the thing is, in 2020, he probably thought to himself, well, you know what? It's good to be allowed the Somalis to cash in on America. It's not going to matter. I'm not going to pay the price. In fact, I'm going to get their vote. And he was able to get that vote, win again by a pretty good margin, and then become vice president, the vice presidential nominee. So I hear about the California fraud. I want to see it now. I hear that they're in Maine. I want to see it now. So you got to put it in front of people and then make these people go and answer these questions. You know, we had Paul LePage on, the former governor. He talked about how the current governor was his attorney general, and she looked the other way. She would not prosecute anything. He tried to get Barack Obama's attention. He was not interested. To talk about the mad fraud happening in Maine. So we know about Minnesota. We know about California. I want these people to either give the money back or go to jail or something. And I want to find out who took the cash out of the country. All right, when we come back, We talked to Ari Sacher. He's a Iraqi rocket scientist, knows all about missile defense. And man, do we need it now. By the way, I hear about the beam. They have lasers taking out missiles.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
They have the Iron Dome, and now they just started using something they call the Iron Beam, directed energy to defend themselves. That is a great cost curve for defenders, and I hope that we start utilizing those types of capabilities here at home and then in our interests around the world as well.
Well, that is General John Tigert, and I spoke to him yesterday on Fox and Friends, too, and I asked him about the Iron Beam. It's a laser. And why do people reluctant to admit they have it? I'm not sure. I'm about to find out. But Israel's evidently using it. What could be more cost effective than that? Ari Sacher joins us now. Israeli rocket scientist, 3 decades of experience on anti-missile technology, including the Iron Dome. Senior policy advisor to the U.S. and Israeli Education Association. Manny, you're busy now. Ari, first off, are you concerned about the number of interceptors we have available from the Gulf states to the state of Israel?
Everybody's concerned. Nobody knows the real numbers, but everybody's concerned about the rate in which they're being fired. I mean, Iran's firing off between 200 and 400 of these Shahed drones that carry about 50 kilo of high explosives. They cost about $35,000. And we're shooting them down with Patriots, with all sorts of other stuff that cost a couple of million dollars a shot. So do the math. I mean, you're worried about how many of your interceptors you have, and you're worried about how much it's costing you.
So they're real. They're legitimate. We just don't know the answer to that.
Oh, they're 100% legit. I mean, these things, I mean, they do damage. You've seen what happens when they aren't shot down. They took out Aramco in Saudi. They took out a U.S. radar in Bahrain. They're taking out all sorts of stuff. I mean, we as the Israelis here in Israel, we're lucky because we got a lot of time before they get to us, pick them up on the radar and shoot them down while they're still over places like, I don't know, Jordan, Saudi. But the people that are closer, I mean, they got a lot of problems.
Yeah. What about the beam, this laser beam? Could you tell me what the theory is behind it?
Yeah, Iron Beam. It's like out there. It's I call it not hit to kill, but heat to kill. So we just focus the laser beam on a bad boy, and you wait long enough, which is not very long at all. The bad boy starts to burn and falls out of the sky. And the nice thing about that is it's essentially free. It just costs the amount of electricity that you use for the couple of seconds that you use it. And this thing, we're pulling no punches. In Israel, this has been operational since December of 2025. And it was actually used. There were some. We took some stuff out of the shed, dusted it off, and stuck it out there in 2024 to start taking care of the stuff that Hezbollah was throwing at Israel. And because there's nothing else that could take care of it. And these lasers are real. They work. They're inexpensive. And just like the Shaheds, the drones change the way people attack. Lasers change the way people defend.
Do they have limitations?
Well, everybody's got limitations. I mean, you got a certain amount of range, that's about the limitation.
Okay, because I just don't know why people are reluctant to talk about it. Because it's space age. Because it could be used. I we never were reluctant to talk about the Iron Dome, David Sling, Aero Systems. Why are we reluctant to talk about Iron Beam?
Well, I don't think anybody's reluctant to talk about it. Ask the right questions, get the right answers. Israel has it operational. There's an assembly line. We're putting out these things, ramping up production, ramping up, getting these things over to the IDF as fast as we can. And no one's pulling any punches. No one's hiding anything.
Evidently,
the more people know, the better.
Rain and fog could be detrimental to the beam.
Yeah, rain and fog have a certain effect on the laser beam. It depends. It depends on how bad the rain is. We did some calculations, and we've shown that that more than 95% of the time in Europe, take as an example, the rain is not bad enough to cause any major damage to our performance. I mean, if you use it out there in Iran, oh, for crying out loud, I mean that's like every day of the year it works.
So, Ari, tell me what you think of how Iran is firing back as opposed to the way they did in the 12-day war.
Iran has been severely stunted. They've lost a lot of not only missiles, which the U.S. has taken out more than Israel is, because they're bringing over these B-2s and dropping these very chunky GBU-57s into these underground factories. But everybody, Israel and the U.S., are plunking away at their launchers. And the long pole in the tent is not the amount of missiles you got, because you can't throw them. You got to stick them on a launcher. And these launchers, Israel has destroyed officially more than 300 launchers since the beginning of the war. I was going into bomb shelters 9 times a day on Saturday. Today and yesterday, I ain't going once. The situation has totally changed, and that's why. Complete air dominance.
So what they're also trying to do, if you get into the strategy-wise, they want to rattle the Gulf states. And, you know, I guess 6 rockets went into Qatar, and the UAE is getting hit pretty regularly. They hit the CIA location in Saudi Arabia and a few others. What do you think that approach? What is that about?
I think Iran has realized that they're not going to do any major damage to Israel, and the only thing that they can do is really flail, hit what they can hit. I mean, today they hit Azerbaijan. Are they insane? I mean, Azerbaijan is a very well-equipped country that borders Iran, and any damage Iran does to Azerbaijan, especially considering how much of their arsenal has been blown up over the last couple of days. I mean, they stand to take equal amount of power from Azerbaijan. So I don't know what they're thinking.
So the foreign
minister, it's a country going down in flames.
I think so, too, unless their goal is to rattle these states to the point where their economy can't do anything. For example, they had to shut down the natural gas field in Qatar for the first time in 20 years. They're hoping maybe they don't let life get back to normal and the people pressure their government to disassociate themselves with us. That could be the theory if you extrapolate it out. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it could be the theory, but I think at the end of the day, everybody's got to take a long breath. And if we breathe deep and we stand tall for a number of days or maybe weeks, then the amount of attacks on all of Iran's neighbors will be reduced, just like it's being reduced on Israel. It's being reduced on us first because the bad boys that they have fewer of them, the ones that can hit us. It'll also be reduced in Qatar. It'll also be reduced in Bahrain and the UAE as well. This will be a threat that will never return if we allow Israel and the U.S., now Azerbaijan, time to destroy the threat completely. That is happening as we speak.
All right, I guess it doesn't surprise you that behind the scenes, Saudi Arabia was pushing Trump to act. All of these Arab countries. Now, in the beginning, they said, we don't want you to use our bases. What are you doing? But behind the scenes, they said, please do this, Mr. President. Follow through. So maybe you can make sense of it being that maybe you understand the Middle East more than my audience.
Well, I'll tell you, everybody is scared of Iran, especially there's two basic kinds of Islam. You have the Shia and you have Sunni. And the Sunnis, most of them are more moderate than the Shia. And the Shia is essentially centered in Iran. There are little branches in Lebanon and other places. But the Sunnis are typically more more down to earth. But there is a tremendous amount of interfamily unhappiness between the two. And at the end of the day, I mean, I just heard yesterday the Qasem Soleimani, who was killed by the U.S. a number of years ago. He was the head of their overseas terrorist office. He said that the country we have to worry about is not Jerusalem. We have to worry about Riyadh. Iran, the Shia, and the Sunnis will forever hate each other. And that plays into the hands. And that's how the Abraham Accords worked out. Israel and moderate Sunni states against a common enemy, Iran.
I hear you. So let's talk about missile defense. We're trying to build a golden dome here. In theory, it's going to be trillions of dollars. But I think people look at what's happening now and they say, if you really want to secure a country, how else would you do it if you're America? The chances of that working, I know Space Force is playing a big role for that. And what do you think the future of missile defense is? I've been impressed with what we see, but it's not perfect. Where do you think we're heading with it?
Look, the country that has the most up-to-date and hermetic, if that's at all possible, missile defense system is Israel. And it's a layered defense system. You have the shortest range is Iron Dome going all the way up through David's Sling and Arrow 2, all the way up to Arrow 3. And one of the advantages of Israel is such a small country so that we can have a reasonable number of batteries defending this small country. The U.S., slightly larger. Israel is the size of New Jersey. Do the math. So if you use these kind of systems to protect systems like, I don't know, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, well, that's great. But then to start using them to defend the entire U.S., that becomes problematic. And therefore, you have these space-based interceptors, which will be part of the Golden Dome. The question is, what can we bring to the table now? We have absolutely nothing. You're shooting down drones in El Paso. In order to do that, you take out a laser and you shut down airspace over El Paso for 12 days. You can't live that way. So the United States has to look. They have to determine, all right, we have a problem with drones. We have a problem with the potential of a problem for an Iranian ship at sea to fire drones into America. We have ballistic missiles that could be landing in American cities. So let's take the systems out there that are proven, that exist, that have saved lives. Let's put as many of them as we can now. And then in parallel, we'll work in a space-based system to take out the other stuff. I think that's the way ahead.
Can we get better than what we have now? Can we get, instead of improving on the Patriot, is there more engineering that you would like to see in R&D to make them even better?
Oh, well, there's some great stuff going on. I mean, look at the statistics in Israel. I mean, the official statistics from Gaza and Lebanon with Iron Dome, I mean, that's greater than 90%. And the official statistics of the Arrow 3 against those Iranian monsters that they fired at us with a ton of high explosives, that was 86%. That's pretty good. It means out of every 100, 15 of them are going to fall. Not all of them are going to fall and kill people. So maybe we can tweak that up a little bit higher. I think if the Patriot is an older system, even the newer Patriot, it's not created to hit the same stuff the same THAAD is created. So you can take Patriots, take THAADs, take some of the Israeli stuff, which has been proven, and make layers. Missile defense systems are like ogres. They work in layers. So that's what you guys got to do.
So what about with the pioneering in Ukraine, and they're working on their way of taking down drones without using Patriots, because obviously you did the math to start this segment. So have you been seeing what Ukraine's been developing?
I have. Ukraine says, if you guys are going to fire a drone at me, well, I'm going to take it out with a drone of my own. And they've dropped the equation from 35K on their side to a million on our side to 35K on their side, and I'll shoot it down with 35K on my side. That's more reasonable. So that is definitely a solution for a certain set of drones. I don't believe it's a solution for all the drones. I don't think it's a solution for the Shaheds that we have right now, because they're coming in very high and very fast. And these things that the Ukrainians are offering are smaller. That said, using that as a concept, very interesting concept. It's something definitely worth looking into. And there are companies around the globe, other than the Ukraine, that are actually looking into these things as well.
I think Ukraine says any nation that's helped us out, we're going to help them out. And they took a pause from peace talks with Russia just to do that. And I was able to go to Germany at Wiesbaden, and it is like War University, the Ukraine. They're going to school on what Ukraine and Russia has been doing, changing the face of war. I'm sure you've noticed all this, Ari.
I have. I mean, I've noticed we've learned a lot in Israel. We've learned a lot from what goes on in the Ukraine as a function of tactics, what to expect the enemy to do. And by golly, I mean, the Iranians are using tactics very similar to the tactics used both by the Ukrainians and by the Russians, which are proven very successful, which is why they're being replicated. And so what we need to do is also to learn from what's going on now in Israel, what's going on now in Bahrain, what's going on now in UAE. And we're going to learn from that. We're going to change our tactics, modify our tactics, and we're also probably going to modify the systems that we have out there. Maybe build new ones, maybe modify old ones.
All right. Thanks so much. Always insightful to have you on. Ari Sasha, who joins us as we try to unwind missile defense, and pretty much in awe of what people like you have been able to accomplish and really
Thank
save a
much.
Nation. You save Israel. You really have. Thanks so much, Ari. Back in a moment.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. A talk show that's real. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
True, it seems that Iran's potential successors keep getting killed. But everyone here at Fox still believes we have the perfect guy for the job. And remember Iran's plot to assassinate Trump? The leader of that operation hunted down and killed. Everyone's gone. Their war room is as empty as a Kilmeade book signing.
What is going on? That's two. That's two. I didn't say anything yet. So that was Greg Gutfeld having fun with me on my introduction. You know, he doesn't really talk to you until after the monologue, so I didn't have a chance to even really interact with him until I was the subject of that. Now, do I have any, I know you went to law school, Allison. Do I have any legal standing to sue him for this type of defamation?
I mean, is it really defamation? I mean,
oh, you mean it's accurate that I have empty book signings? It's accurate that I should be Grand Ayatollah?
Out of all the book signings, no, they're actually very packed, which proves that Greg has never been to one.
Right.
But it was a joke.
Well, most of them. Well, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to snap.
Do you want to hear more of your time with Greg last night?
Sure.
His first name is spelled like brain, and that's where the similarities end. Host of Fox and Friends in One Nation, Brian Kilmeade. Brian, I've missed all of your commentary on this because I don't get up that early.
Right.
I'm assuming it's as banal as always, but give us your, what do you call your 35,000 foot view of
right.
this.
Probably 32,000 foot, but let's just but it's high. By the way, Sunday's at 10 also, if you prefer that time slot.
Well, no, I don't.
Yeah, I thought so.
Where do these mentalists come from?
Mental institutions?
That's probably the hardest question I've ever been asked. How do I answer that question? Where do mentalists come from? Why do I get that question?
Magician, all right, I'll ask you a different question.
Thank you.
Would you like a different one?
Without Vaseline in it.
Okay. Are you going to go?
I haven't gone in a long time. I want to go now. How do you feel about asking me that question now? Do you want me to go, what are mentalists?
I appreciate the fact that you answered the question four different ways. Brian, do you understand this now? You said you didn't understand the story. And because of sexual market value, none of us were surprised.
Right.
So the whole thing, I still don't understand that last story. Do you understand what this is called? This is a site called Bidsy, Bidsey, where you put your value, which you think your sexual marketplace value is. And then if people want to date you, they got to match your value.
You like bid on you to do it.
Right. I mean, and then I guess you go with the highest bid.
That could be. Actually, we have a little bit of Tyrus talking about that because I thought his take on it was quite interesting.
Men know their sexual market value. Check your pay stub.
That's so cynical.
It's not cynical. You're a breadwinner and you're successful. You can have a face like Jim Carrey. If you got $10 billion in the bank, they don't give a damn.
What about true love?
True love? You should have met her in high school.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's just this type of stuff is sexual market value. A woman is not going to bid on you. Another man will. But a woman is not going to bid on you.
Right.
That's so true.
You're going to be all oiled up. Like, I can do the flat camera zoom. Look at all the stuff I got. It doesn't matter.
What do you mean?
Women don't care about those things. Mm. They don't.
What do they care about?
As soon as I figure that out, I'll let you know.
So that was me interacting with Tyrus, but he believes if you have money, women will find you attractive.
I know, and I understand why he might think that, but I think what was so endearing about that comment is just you're like, no, what about true love? What about all the things that should matter in a relationship?
Right.
And you were...
But you know I was just trying to take the opposite view to get him crazy.
Agreed, because if you'd really felt it, be like, yes, true love, I met my wife in high school.
Right, didn't have time for that.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Reno, Nevada, May 30th. July 11th, Evansville, Indiana, a chance to interact and find out your true sexual market price in person. BrianKilmeade.com.